supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And in the question of the week, we will tackle the burning topic of putting plants on a driveway, if that's the only place near your house that gets enough sun to grow those tasty tomatoes. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, that's right. Potential guests are busy out working their driveways, so we're going to take that heaping helping of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Josh, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, Josh. How are you, man?
Pretty good. How are you?
I am just ducky, sir. Where is Josh pretty good?
I'm from Sundance, Wyoming.
Whoa! That sounds like a little bit of paradise.
Yeah, it is. You guys have been getting all our snow, so thanks.
Now, is that where the Sundance Kid was from?
That's where he got his name.
Oh, okay. Very good. We don't get a lot of calls from Wyoming. That's fun. All right, what can we do for Josh and Sundance?
Well, I'd heard that the Native Americans used to bury a fish below their plants to help fertilize and grow their plants, and I was wondering if it was safe to do or if it would work. I have some tomatoes and some peppers I want to try growing this year.
And yet, Josh, Native Americans did not grow tomatoes and peppers, did they?
No, they didn't. That's true. So then I'm going to grow some other stuff. I was just wondering if that would work for that or if it would be safe or not.
Well, there's all these stories about what the Native Americans did and didn't do. One thing we know for certain is with things like fish and bison and the wild game they caught is they used every part of the skin, every little bone. There was nothing going to waste. So there is some thought that the non-edible remnants of fish were buried in fields that would later be used to grow their primitive form of what we now call corn. And the early forms of maize as they were being developed, I actually got to grow one of these primitive corns years ago. And it's crazy, man. The plants look pretty much identical, but instead of you getting a husk with kernels inside, you get a husk with kernels inside, each of which have their own husk over each kernel. It's really wild. And then later on, they developed their own breeding techniques and came out with these fabulous colored corns, candy apple red and metallic green. And these are the corns that they would almost exclusively grow for drying and then making into cornmeal and things like that to get through the winter time. And In this case, if you're going to be growing field corn or sweet corn, fish fertilizer, in quotes, is an excellent idea. A fish is very high in nitrogen as a fertilizer, and that's all corn wants. Corn wants sunshine, nitrogen, and lots of water. So in this case, it would work. However, what we hear about a lot is people who try to imitate this is they get raccoon problems. Raccoons are already attracted to fields of sweet corn. They're going to sit around waiting for it to ripen. But if they can smell the fish underground, they're going to dig it up and ruin the field. So it would depend on your critter protection. If you're growing your sweet corn inside like an electric fence that's designed to keep out raccoons and creatures like that, you can certainly experiment with it. I wouldn't. Do you have fish waste? Are you a fisherman and you have the heads and the fins and everything left over when you're done scaling them and everything?
I am, and I do, yes. So I was just hoping to put it to some use instead of just throwing it in the trash. So
Right.
I'll try that. I have some corn, too, so I'll try that out.
That's the direct line. Fish grows corn really well. I wouldn't necessarily use it as a fertilizer on fruiting crops like tomatoes and peppers, because if the nitrogen content is high enough, it'll make the plants grow big, but it'll inhibit flowering, which will mean fewer fruits for you.
Okay.
And, you know, you could theoretically blend the fish up with seaweed and make a balanced fertilizer for fruiting crops. That's one of my favorite fertilizers. If I ever use an organic fertilizer, is a blend of fish and seaweed. It's a great balanced fertilizer. You know, if you're a fisherman, the smell, you know, the mess. You know.
Yeah.
But try it with some protected sweet corn or field corn and let us know how you do.
All right, I will. Thank you for your help.
All right. Good luck, Josh.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
1-888-346-9499. Marianne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. I live in Middletown Township near Media, actually right next to the Tyler Arboretum, close to Ridley State Park.
Ridley State Park is famous for deer infestations.
Yeah. We also have plenty of ticks here, but it's just beautiful.
All right. I'm going to stop you right there.
Okay.
Because this is something I haven't talked about, I think, in several years.
Uh-huh.
But there is a product you can buy called tick tubes, little cardboard tubes, a little smaller than toilet paper cores.
Uh-huh.
And they're stuffed with cotton balls that are soaked with permethrin, which is the synthetic form of the botanical insecticide pyrethrum. And in all of its forms, it's deadly to ticks. So in areas where you have a lot of deer, a lot of mice, a lot of ticks, you think of the deer as bringing in the ticks, but they actually come in on mice.
Okay.
So
I have a cat that goes out.
You put these tubes around the outskirts of your property.
Uh-huh.
The mice take the cotton balls to use as bedding. They take them back to their nests, and they don't hurt the mice, but they kill any ticks that come in on the mice. Although we call the ticks that carry Lyme disease deer ticks, many of them have never seen a deer, but they all have to go through part of their life cycle on the white-footed field mouse.
Oh, I didn't know that.
All right, now let's move on to what you called about.
Oh, okay. All the animals, not just the deer. I had to get a greenhouse to grow anything, especially if I wanted to eat anything I grew. So last fall, I took cuttings of lavender, rosemary, sage. I've been growing them. And they're about 5 to 6 inches tall now and ready to transplant into larger pots or in the garden. But over the winter, they started getting white powder on the leaves. Now, I have a book called The Greenhouse Gardener's Companion, and he recommends three things. One is sulfur, but he said not to use that if you're going to eat. Use it for food. The other is a baking soda spray, and the other is a horsetail tea and silicone, which I never heard of. But I wanted to check with you. I trust you on what I could put on them or what I should do.
I overwinter my rosemary plants inside the house,
and
they are very prone to developing these white powdery patches on them. I would expect that lavender would act the same. In the future, this is an airflow and drainage problem. You want to make sure your cuttings are in a loose, light, soil-free mix with lots of perlite. No garden soil, nothing heavy. Rosemary and lavender both only want one thing, and that's superb drainage and good airflow.
Okay.
So when I had my greenhouse, I had a regular fan, like a tabletop fan. And I had that blowing on the plants 24/7 to keep the air moving around the plants. And that is the easiest way to prevent these problems.
Oh, okay.
Your book, they're all three are natural and organic. Sulfur is pretty hardcore. That's used outside on like grapevines and stuff.
Uh-huh.
If he describes the Cornell formula, that's the baking soda spray.
Yeah.
This was developed at Cornell University. That's actually an excellent preventative. So what I would do is I would take these things and I would get them to an area where I had a sharp spray of water, like an adjustable nozzle where I could really blast them.
Uh-huh.
And I would really blast them down, and then I would use the Cornell formula on them, which is a little bit of baking soda and a little bit of oil in like a pint of water. If you're not sure of the recipe, you can go to our website, and we have okay. the Cornell formula up there. And then keep the fan on them. Get that air flowing around them, and you shouldn't have the problem again. The horsetail tea is very interesting. Horsetail is a weed that does have a lot of silica, a lot of a substance like sand in it. It was used before the turn of the century to actually scrub pots. So it's very abrasive, and horsetail tea may be a natural disease preventer for all I know. Because this is powdery mildew, and it just washes right off, right? But then it comes back.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Wash it off real good. Spray it off real hard, like a stream of water that hurts your hand.
Okay. Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And then the Cornell formula, and then great airflow. Get that fan going on them, and they'll be very happy.
Okay. Oh, that's great. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck.
I enjoy listening to you every Saturday morning.
Oh, thank you so much, Mayor.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and alert our Virginia listeners to the fact that I'll be giving two talks at the Leesburg Flower and Garden Festival on Sunday, April 19th in Leesburg, Virginia. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with advice on how to turn the driveway into a plantway and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com. And by the Espoma Company, makers of Holly Tone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it's a problem many of us have. The only good sun on a property falls right on a blacktop driveway that gets hot as Hades over the summer. Can it somehow be turned into a garden? Yeah, we'll tell you how. After lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Eric, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there, Mike. How are you?
I am just fine today, Eric. How are you, sir?
I'm well. I'm well. Thanks for asking.
And where is Eric well?
I live in Kinnelon, New Jersey, off of Route 23 and 287, and it's one of the most beautiful areas in New Jersey, mountains and lakes.
Oh, okay. Very good. Jersey has such a diverse set of microclimates. It's got almost everything.
It really does. Yeah, there's something for everybody.
All right, what can we do for Eric?
Well, I have a lot of laurel on my property, as do most of my neighbors, and there's a lot of die-off happening in the last several years. We're getting these sort of rusty, dark, rusty spots on the leaves, and some of the spots have sort of a grayish-white center to them, and the leaves are dying and falling off, and they're basically less and less leaves every year. And that's one problem. Another problem is I have a green lichen that's growing on some of the branches of some of them in one part of my property. And that's also seems to be killing off the shrubs. So any ideas?
But you say this is not limited to your property. This is a neighborhood-wide kind of thing?
Yep. There seems to be a lot of die-off of laurel and rhododendron, too.
I know there is a rhododendron disease out there, but I also find that most people who think they had a rhododendron disease just didn't care for their plants correctly. Now, do these plants get good sun? And before you answer that, let me also add, has their sun declined over the years as trees around them perhaps have grown much larger?
Well, that's very possible. The only thing that I sort of have noticed is that I've lived here for only about 4 years. And the year that we moved in, at least as far as I noticed, the laurel and the rhododendrons were doing good. They had a lot more leaves. The leaves were very green.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the last 4 years, I guess, or more, there seems to be a decline. Now, I didn't pay much attention to whether these spots were on the leaves or not. But I sure noticed when the leaves started dropping and the plants started declining.
Have you fed these plants?
I have.
What have you fed them?
Polytone, mostly.
Okay. Have you mulched them?
No, I have not.
Okay. What do you mean mostly? But I'm going to go back there.
Well, chicken manure as well.
Why? Because you had it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And someone said it was a good idea.
Composted chicken manure, and I hope to God it was composted, is a natural fertilizer, but it's incredibly potent. It
right.
is as high nitrogen as some chemical fertilizers, and it's an excellent natural food for lawns and sweet corn, but mountain laurel and cherry laurels are native plants that are very much used to getting along without any kind of food. And a lot of times these things that look like diseases are caused by a combination of poor drainage, lack of sun, and overfeeding. We've been pretty wet lately over the last couple of years. Is the area where they are, does it drain well? Do you have those sandy soils or do you have clay soil?
I probably have a mixture. I guess when you get down pretty deep, it can get fairly clay, but the surface soils are actually pretty good. We have quite a high worm population and some nice
now,
black soil.
Do you do any supplemental watering of these plants?
I do not.
Okay. All right. So here's what we're going to do. If possible, take a good, honest look at them and see how much sun they're getting. See if there's perhaps a little bit of selective pruning you can do on the plants around them to improve the airflow and the sun to them.
Right.
And then this season, instead of any kind of fertilization, back off on any kind of, like, quote, food right now. What I would do is I would put down an inch of milled peat moss, you know, those big bricks they sell at the garden center. And then cover that with an inch of compost and then let that be. I think the peat moss will help replicate the kind of conditions that these plants were greatly adapted to when they began. And the compost will not only feed them naturally, but it will prevent any kind of disease spores that blow into your area from getting a foothold. The lichen... Is the lichen only on parts of the plants that face north, or are they all mostly northern exposure?
Well, that is a very good question. I would say, let's see, east, west, north. Yeah, I would say they're on the northern exposure.
You know, that's how you know where you are in the woods. That's how you know right. where north is. So right. I think you really got to open up that area both ways. You got to prune some of the bigger plants around it. And I think you also have to open up the laurels themselves. They've probably become too crowded for the area that they have to survive in. The best laurels I've seen are growing in full sun. And mm-hmm. it's not even so much the sun, it's the airflow. There's no airflow there. So anything that gets started on these plants is just going to get worse. So we're going to stop feeding. We're going to put down peat moss and compost. We're going to try to thin the area around it for airflow. And I want you to give the plants a light pruning this spring. And then just keep an eye out. And if you see any leaves that develop this condition, mm-hmm. pull them off. As soon as you see them, pull them off and throw them in the trash. You know, a season or two of that, you should be able to break the cycle. But look at these plants and always think, how can I get them more airflow?
Okay.
All right, man?
Sounds great. Thank you for your help.
All right. Good luck, Eric.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Elena, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Elena. How are you?
I'm fine.
Very good. And where is...
I'm in southeastern Wisconsin.
Don't be sorry. I hear it's a very nice place.
So I'm having problems with iris borers. Mm-hmm. I discovered them for the first time last August. I noticed the whole area was decimated, and so I dug them up and found the terrible creature. I then went forward and looked on the internet and found various things to do, and they said to soak them in a bleach solution.
Oh, my goodness. Throw away your computer. Stop going to wherever. Good God. Bleach. What do you want? White irises?
They said to do the solution and then leave them out and then replant them in a different area. I ended up throwing out most of them anyhow. So,
yeah, but they were nice and clean and white.
Yeah, maybe that was silly, but they said that the big thing was in the spring, something has to be done. They said, put some horrible chemicals on them, and you know I want to do everything organically despite the bleach. So I thought I would call you and find out, is there something I should do in spring? Because I know I did get rid of all the debris, and I hear they hatch an egg on the rhizome, and so I don't know if there's something natural I can do to prevent those eggs from hatching.
Yes. You don't have to prevent them from hatching. You can get the young caterpillar. So you have an organic garden except for the use of the trench gas liquid.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, good. Now, you know, one thing that's important about iris is that they not be planted deeply.
Oh, I know. Mine are way on the top.
Okay, good. So here's the life cycle. Sometime in the late summer, midsummer, actually, night flying moths will come into your garden while you sleep, and they will lay their eggs down at the base of your iris. It's my understanding that the eggs then overwinter, the actual pest hatches out in the spring, and then does like minor damage to the leaves. If you keep an eye out, the leaves will show signs of like little tunnels in them, like leaf miner damage.
Okay.
And then only after that does this caterpillar, and it's a true caterpillar, the child of a moth, start digging into the rhizome itself. All caterpillars are vulnerable to BT. BT is the oldest organic pest control. It's sold under brand names like Dipel. D-I-P-E-L is the big one. That's like you go into a garden center, you ask for Dipel. It's like Tylenol. They may give you a different brand name, but they know what you mean. But the important thing is, you know, you're looking for the organic caterpillar control, and it'll have the letters B-T-K. Okay. B-T stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, and K stands for Kerstaki. That's the original strain that was found. It's a natural soil-dwelling organism. You don't have to remember any of the Latin, just the BT that kills caterpillars. So as soon as your plants start growing again in the spring, you can start spraying BT on the leaves preventively. If you missed any eggs, if you missed any larvae, when they come out and they start munching on the leaves, as soon as they take a bite of the sprayed leaves, they'll die. but it will harm absolutely nothing else in your garden. It's no threat to you, earthworms, birds, toads, anything. It only affects caterpillars, and it only affects caterpillars who eat the sprayed leaves. Now, if you want to go for the gold, after your flowers are all faded for the season, and the greenery is starting to fade down, you know, you can dig these up and store them. Or you can cover them with what's called remade. This is a floating row cover.
Oh, good.
Your local extension service will be able to tell you within a week or two when these flying creatures, the moths, are in the air. So, say, beginning on August 1st, if you put these remade covers over your iris and kept them on till September, the moths won't be able to get through. They can't lay their eggs. The cycle is broken. They'll go elsewhere.
Oh, good. I wish I had known that last year because I worry about all my different iris patches. But I will do that this year for sure.
And don't leave any lights on at night.
Oh, good.
Because that attracts the moths.
Well, I feel much better. I really don't want to lose any more iris, and this seems like a really great solution.
Yeah, it's a pest that really plagues people who love this flower, but you can get it under control.
Okay, great.
Good luck. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Bob. How are you?
I'm great in Frenchtown, New Jersey.
Very good. What can we do for Bob in Frenchtown?
Well, we never had this problem before, but I'm right in the middle of town, and my neighbor told me last year that he had some of his vegetables eaten by deer, and now I've had deer coming in and eating from my compost pile.
You know, there really shouldn't be anything in your compost pile that would appeal to them, Bob. What do you got out there?
Well, like peels from squash and onion peels.
A lot of people start a compost pile because they want to recycle their kitchen waste. But what they don't understand is that in an open pile, that kind of kitchen waste, it's unusual for it to attract deer. That kind of surprises me. What generally you get is raccoons digging in the pile, and they're very dangerous creatures. It's also anywhere, city, country, the most rural places in the world, you're going to attract mice and rats, which is why if people are going to compost a lot of vegetable waste, I urge them to either get a worm bin and do it indoors or to get one of those sealed black plastic composters.
Yeah.
And even then, you know, you got to have a lot of well-shredded leaves in the mix for it to become good compost.
Yeah, I do.
Okay. I wouldn't worry about your compost, although I would sometime over the course of this season build or buy a composter that is sealed that you'll use for your kitchen waste. What kind of a garden do you have to protect? What size is it? Where is it? What does it look like?
Well, what I have is 5 plots that are about 12 foot long by 4 foot wide.
Oh, that's a nice setup.
Yeah.
Obviously, you don't want to get involved with a lot of fencing, right?
Well, I thought if I have to, I have to. But I don't even know if they're going to let me put an 8-foot-high fence in Frenchtown.
Well, with something like this, and you say you're in the city, so it's probably not a good idea. If you are out in the country, you can buy really good electric fence kits online that are just like 3 strands of wire, the specialized non-conductive stakes, and then you get a solar panel that powers the fence. So the charge is enough to get the attention of a deer that leans against the wire, but it's not nearly as hot as the old-style electric fence that ran off like a car battery or off of the household AC. So I don't know if that would suit your situation. What I'm going to suggest is very simple. Do you have a water supply near the garden? You have a hose and a spigot?
Yeah.
Go out and get yourself a motion-activated sprinkler. These are devices that are on a big stake you put in the ground. They have a big head with an impact sprinkler on the top. You hook it up. You put a 9-volt battery in the head. you hook it up to your garden hose, turn your garden hose on full blast, and then nothing happens until something breaks the infrared beam. And then the sprinkler hits them with a couple of cups of cold water. Well, it is perfect for deer. Deer are a big target. They startle easily. So if you aim this sprinkler in the direction the deer are coming from, they'll get hit with cold water before they can get into your garden.
Uh-huh.
And these things are not expensive. They're like $60, $70, much less expensive than fencing. And this you only buy it once, and mine have lasted anywhere between 7 and 10 years each, depending on how well I've taken care of them.
Well, that sounds like a great idea.
The biggest brand name and the one that I use that seems to work the best, that has the best controls, is called The Scarecrow.
How many do you think I would need?
I would start out with one, see how you do, and then if you see you need more, you add on.
Okay, great. That sounds like a great idea.
It saves my garden. It's exactly what protects my garden from deer every summer. All right, Bob?
Terrific. Thank you.
All right, good luck, sir.
Love your program.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a break and remind our itchy-fingered listeners, yes, that's you, that there are many reasons why April has been called the cruelest month. Number one may be the season-long damage caused by gardeners working in wet soil. So grow cool weather crops like lettuce, carrots, and peas in containers right now, and wait to work in your real dirt until the soil is dry. But don't go putting those shovels away just yet, because we'll be right back with advice on how to turn the driveway into a plantway and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Hollytone brand organic plant food, developed for feeding hollies, azaleas, evergreens, and other acid-loving plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And Mole Zap and Ant Zap. The onset of spring also means the return of pests. Mole Zap and Ant Zap's OMRI-listed organic, child, and pet-safe solutions are designed to leave no runoff or chemical residue. More at antzap.com and molezap.com. Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating their 139th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, fruits of all kinds, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com and MoleZap and AntZap. The onset of spring also means the return of pests. MoleZap and AntZap's OMRI-listed organic, child, and pet-safe solutions are designed to leave no runoff or chemical residue. More at antzap.com and molezap.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week, a problem that many of you may have. What can you do when the best sun on your property falls directly on a driveway that heats up and gets burning hot in the middle of summer? Can it be turned into an oasis for plants? Yeah. We'll tell you how after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Tom. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing just ducky, thank you. And where is Tom great?
I'm great in Marion Station, right outside Philly.
What can we do for Tom just outside of Philly?
Well, I put in some raised bed gardens in the backyard.
Good.
As a matter of fact, I did it according to the square foot gardener approach to life, which is wonderful. And we put in some tomato plants, and the squirrels just absolutely are killing us. They're munching on every tomato and nibbling on each one, not eating them all.
Yes.
And pretty much ruining our yield.
Yes. First of all, you have to call them by their correct scientific name, Tom. It's not squirrels. It's evil squirrels. And it's been proven that evil squirrels do not even like tomatoes. That's why they just take a single bite out of each one, because then we put on a great show coming running out in our underwear swinging brooms at them, and they find it very amusing. So, I presume you are not growing your tomatoes inside cages.
That's correct.
That's the first thing you got to do. You've done the hard part. You've already built the raised beds. And in your case, you already know your enemy. So go to the home store and get welded wire fencing that has holes in it that are too small for a squirrel to squeeze through. Now, you're going to have to get tricky about harvesting your tomatoes, but it's worth it. So you cut 6-foot linear lengths, lay it out on your driveway, cut a 6-foot linear length, turn that into a tube, and then you've got a cylinder that's around 2 feet across the top. Put that over top of the centered area of your tomato plant, and don't restrict the plant. You need to stake the cage if you're growing big tomatoes. Drive some rebar through the cage to hold it in place late in the season when you got a lot of tomatoes out there. But don't stake the tomato itself. Tomatoes are vines. They will always reach towards the sun, but they are non-attaching vines. They don't cling to anything. So they're just going to lean against the side of the cage, and you can have a 12-foot long tomato vine inside a 5-foot cage with the entire plant inside there. And then take some of the wire and make a top for the cage that you can just twist tie on and off. Now, if you do that, you're just done. So now they can't get at your tomatoes anymore. A way to protect your entire garden. I know your neighborhood, the plots are not big, so this garden is probably in a very well-defined area. You can buy a product called the Scarecrow. It is a motion-activated sprinkler. You set it up, put a 9-volt battery in the head, point it towards your garden, and it has an impact sprinkler on top, and you'll aim the settings so that they have the right width and the right pitch. And then you'll hook it up to your hose, turn your hose on full blast, and nothing will happen until something breaks the beam. And then it will shoot a couple of cups of cold water at them. Well, squirrels despise this. Cats hate it. Deer can't stand it. It's a great way to keep multiple types of critters out of your garden.
Yeah. So how do you go about harvesting once you have those cages on? Do you have to open them up every time you try to harvest? Or
you will have a removable top, and then try to arrange it so that you can stand next to the cage without stepping into your raised beds, lift up the top, and get your arm down as far as you can. But if you get some good-looking tomatoes at the bottom, all you'll do is take your wire cutters, you'll make yourself a little door. You'll open up one of the little wires, and then you'll close it after you're done.
All right.
Now, if you want to get even, you can also set up a tomato plant unprotected. And actually, for this, you also need a supply of red Christmas balls, the glass balls you put on a Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to get even, you can have a kind of a fake tomato plant out there and hang these red Christmas balls on it. The squirrels will never come back.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the input, Mike, and I'm looking forward to giving it a shot.
Go out and fight the good fight, Tom.
All right. Thanks so much. Love your show.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Charles, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you doing?
I am doing just fine today, Charles. How are you, sir?
A little soggy and wet, but other than that, just great.
And where is Charles soggy and wet?
Chester County, Pennsylvania.
Oh, sure, out by the Brandywine Valley and Longwood Gardens, all those horticultural show places. What can we do for Charles and a little bit of Pennsylvania paradise?
I was wondering about Jersey tomatoes and why they seem to taste better than others.
Well, is this a childhood memory?
Yes.
Okay, because so many people come to my show, come to my books, used to come to Organic Gardening Magazine because they're trying to recreate that tomato of their youth that they remember eating fresh picked warm on a hot summer day. And it was the perfect blend of acid and sugar with all these back flavors. And people spend their whole lives trying to recreate not only that, but, you know, their grandmother's favorite recipe and all those other things. Mm-hmm. One reason is Jersey is the Garden State, and a lot of tomatoes were grown in Jersey. Obviously, there weren't any farms in Philadelphia. There were farms out in Westchester, but big commercial farms were in New Jersey, and there were three types of very specialized Jersey tomatoes. There were the Campbell's tomatoes. These were seeds that were selected by Campbell's Soup for their tomato soup that were given to farmers to grow out for Campbell's. So these were tomatoes that had passed every level of inspection. And rather than the ones that are bred for supermarket processing, these were bred to be picked fresh and rushed to the cannery and used while they were still warm. For many years, Heinz used to grow their tomatoes in New Jersey as well. And for many years, I was able to get the old original Heinz seed and grew out the tomatoes, which made the best tomato sauce. And my father, who was living with us at the time, preferred these meaty paste tomatoes to big juicy tomatoes because he said they didn't make the sandwich all wet and they had this dynamite flavor. Now, there is a third school of thought that the Jersey tomato is Rutgers, which was, of course, developed at Rutgers University. And this was a tomato that was bred to be incredibly flavorful, but also very easy for the home gardener to grow because it was designed to be grown in Victory Gardens, the second run of Victory Gardens during World War II. Victory Garden started in the First World War, the one that was going to end all the wars. But Rutgers released this fabulous tomato right around the beginning of World War II, and there are many people who feel that Rutgers is the Jersey tomato. They also have good soils. There's a high proportion of sand in their soils compared to our clay. But there is also the fact that back then, probably not a lot of chemical fertilizers were being used, so the tomatoes would have more flavor. When you use things like Miracle-Gro or Osmocote or any 10-10-10 or any of these chemical fertilizers on a tomato, it makes the tomato fill up with water and be less flavorful. So back then, a lot of growers were organic just because they didn't have a lot of options. And they were growing closer to the ground. They were more in tune with the earth. It was real farming. It wasn't this massive city-sized machinery. But that's why we teach people to grow backyard tomatoes, to grow them in compost, to give them good morning sun, and to spend years seeking out that perfect variety. But if you want to try to find the Jersey tomato, I'm going to suggest one of the varieties you try be Rutgers.
Rutgers, okay, like the university.
Correct. And you can still get it. It's widely available.
Well, regards from the Twin S Ranch.
All right. Good luck, Charles. Take care, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Can you park your plants on a driveway? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's intriguing question, s'il vous plaît.
Sure, Mike. Penny in the Mount Airy section of Philadelphia writes, would it be possible to garden in a raised bed on my driveway? It's the only place that gets enough sun. Or would it be too hot there for plants? Why are you smiling like that?
Ah, because that's where some of the best sun on my property falls. In fact, I suspect many people's best, quote, garden sun falls on their house, driveway, or some other place that's inconvenient to impossible to grow tomatoes.
But I've been to your house, and you don't use that space for growing.
Well, the flat part of our driveway is right next to the road, way too close to traffic for me. And the, quote, driveway that runs from there to our backyard slopes 8 feet from the front of the house to the back. Our front door takes you into the living room, and the back door goes right into the basement. That is an area better suited to a log flume ride than a garden.
But it sounds like she has a conventional flat blacktop driveway.
And she's right. Blacktop will absorb heat from that good sun exposure during the day, until, as she fears, it generates enough BTUs to cook some of those plants.
So what? She should paint her driveway white?
Ideally, yeah, but can you even paint blacktop? If I were her, I would consider whitewashing a section and see how well that temporary coloring holds up. My second thought is to get the surround clay spray I use to protect my peaches and see how long that lasts on the blacktop. It keeps my peach trees a grayish white for a solid month, and she doesn't need perfection, just something to cut the heat absorption. She should also be able to find big rolls of white paper at restaurant supply stores. She could line the area between the beds with those.
Right, like they cover the tables with at some family restaurant so kids can color with crayons while the parents try to eat in relative peace. So you're saying she should try it?
Absolutely. Frame out boxes that accommodate the size of the driveway but are no wider than 4 feet each. Because just like with conventional raised beds, you always want to be able to reach the center of the boxes without stepping into the nice loose soil.
Would you have the bottoms open to the asphalt?
Personally, no. As with beds on soil, I would cover the area underneath with a single sheet of thick cardboard to prevent contact. And you know, if she can locate a big source of white cardboard, she could make nice white islands with the boxes in the center. That'd break the heat around the boxes and prevent contact with the driveway surface.
Okay. Anything else to consider?
You know, drainage might be an issue if we get a lot of rain because these things are going to sit flush. So I would probably carve some small drainage holes in the bottom sides of the boxes, about half a mouse hole sized each, lined with hardware cloth to keep the soil inside.
This would seem an ideal time of year to remind people of what you mean by, quote, soil in raised beds and containers.
Right you are. The minimum would be a 50-50 mix of rich black screen topsoil and high-quality compost. Not crappy regular garden soil or composted manure or those weird heavy bags labeled garden soil.
Right. What's up with that? Anyway, you call that mixture the minimum.
Yeah. Ideally, you want to lighten it up as well as start with a nice clean blend that doesn't have any of your landscape's ratty clay soil or weed seeds in it. One way to lighten it up would be to mix in a huge bag of perlite or two.
You have become a perlite fiend. How many bags do you go through in a season?
I don't know. I lose count. I just bought a bag that's bigger than a dorm room fridge just to add to my seed starting mixes. And they already had perlite in them. Come on, It's an organic mined mineral, and nothing is better than improving drainage and bringing air to the roots of the plants. And it's not a problem. I can stop using it whenever I want.
Ha! You'll stop when the factory runs out of volcanic glass to pop.
Hush. The best option would probably be one-third compost, one-third screen topsoil, and one-third bagged soil-free mix, one that doesn't contain chemical fertilizers or those stupid water-holding crystals. And a big bag of perlite.
I knew it! Intervention! We're taking you to the Pearly White Clinic.
Keep your hands off my popped rocks. Anyway, if she wants to use the driveway over the winter, I would switch to tabletop gardening. Sturdy outdoor tables on which she can arrange rectangular planters. She'd be able to grow herbs, greens, bush beans, peppers, eggplant, everything except really big tomatoes. For them, I'd do big round containers on wheels so they could be moved easily at the end of the season. And I'd fill all of these containers with the same kinds of mixes.
And maybe a little extra perlite?
Well, that sure was some good advice about turning a driveway into a plantway, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes! My producer's threatening to poach my perlite if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore with your location in the email, which you will send to garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and like us at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz is You Bet Your Garden's Wizard of the Web. The well-drained Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Pearly L. Banks is our editor. Our hired hand, Matt Hudecki, is himself composed of pop volcanic glass. Our intrepid intern, Farah Al-Yukut, has pearly teeth. I'm your host. Yes, perlite mad, pop rock addicted, resolutely resistant to recovery, Mike McGrath. And the only way they'll take away my perlite is to pry it out of my cold, dead fingers. Oh, boy, that sounds harsh, doesn't it? Just seems wrong. Wait. I'm going to change my mind. Yeah, I'm not going to recommend that those of you cursed with non-sandy soil go out and buy big bags of perlite to improve your drainage. That was a mistake. I won't make that again. I take it all back. Because then there'll be more for me. Me. Ha, 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 ha. Yes, mine. It's all mine. All the perlite. The pretty, pretty perlite. All mine. What can you plant to really bring in the birds and the bees? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the Audubon Society's top 10 native plant picks for attracting awesome amounts of auspicious animated aviators. Plus your fabulous phone calls.